This is State of Wonder. I'm Aaron Scott. We're taping our show today at the Wordstock Literary Festival, where thousands have come together to celebrate the almighty book. Every parent is a mystery to their child, but few bear the secrets of Samuel Hawley. His scarred body maps out a life of theft, guns, and murder, but for his daughter Lou, they're just scars. That is, until they settle into the New England hometown of her deceased mother and she begins to question her father's past and what truly happened to her mom. Such is the central mystery of Hannah Tinty's second novel, The 12 Lives of Samuel Hawley. Ann Patchett called it one part Quentin Tarantino, one part Scheherazade, and 12 parts Wild Innovation. Tinty is one of those gloriously creative writers whose plots sparkle with suspense and emotion, and she also co-founded and edits the award-winning magazine One Story. Hannah Tinty, welcome to State of Wonder. So, at the center of this book is a father and a daughter, and before you read for us, would you introduce us to Samuel Hawley and Lou?
Sure. I know it's hard to do this on the radio, but I usually use the actual physical copy of the book to explain about them. So Samuel Hawley is a guy who has been shot 12 times, and you can tell because there's actually holes in the book.
or the book cover.
Of the book cover, I should say. And then underneath is a beautiful star map, and that represents his daughter, Lou, who grows up on the road and finds her way by looking up at the stars.
So would you read for us?
Yes, I'm going to set this up a little bit because the section that I'm reading is actually the very first thing that I wrote in the book. And it's based on a real contest that takes place every year in Gloucester, Massachusetts. I grew up nearby in Salem, where the witches are from. And it explains a lot about my writing, actually, that I'm from Salem. But so this is a contest that takes place, as I said, every year during Fiesta, which is sort of a blessing of the fleet. They bring out a priest. He blesses all the boats with this idea that hopefully none of them will go down during the season. And they attach a pole, 45-foot long pole, out over a town pier. They cover it with grease and lard, nail a flag to the end, and then all the fishermen get really drunk, and the first guy to make it to the end of the pole and capture the flag wins. And it is like America's Funniest Home Videos over and over again, and the whole town comes out, and they're like blasting their horns, and it is a joyous, wonderful, like brutal gladiator kind of contest, and it is very enjoyable to go and watch.
It sounds like there might be a few less fishermen after the end of this.
Yes, they break arms, they do all kinds of things. So writing about that contest is what started the book for me, and I'm just going to read a little bit from that scene. Across his body were rounded scars, bullet holes healed over. One hole in his back, a second through his chest, a third near his stomach, a fourth in his left shoulder, another through his left foot. The scars were dark and puckered in places, as if the bullets that had entered Samuel Hawley had eaten their way through his flesh. A breeze came, and the flag at the end of the pole fluttered, and the town stared while Hawley crouched and rolled his pant legs, revealing two more scarred holes, one in each leg. There was a collective breath, and then the crowd began to murmur. The only person who did not respond was his daughter, piling rocks by the shore. The marks on her father's body had always been there. He did not show them off to Lou, but he did not hide them either. They reminded her of the craters on the moon that she studied at night with her telescope, circles made from comets and asteroids that slammed into the cold, hard rock because it had no protective atmosphere to burn them up. Like those craters, Hawley's scars were signs of previous damage that had impacted his life long before she was born. And like the moon, Hawley was always circling between Lou and the rest of the universe, reflecting light at times, but only in slivers. And then, every 30 days or so, becoming the fullest and brightest object in the sky, as he did now, when he finished rolling his jeans, stood at the edge of the pier, raked his fingers through his beard, stepped onto the greasy pole, and started to dance.
So you tell Holly and Lou's story through this beautiful volley between Lou's perspective in this modern town, fictional town of Olympus, Massachusetts, and then Holly's flashbacks that explain these 12 scars. Where did the idea for this structure come from?
Well, after I wrote that scene about the greasy pole and found, you know, I was just describing one of the guys who was getting onto the pole, and I took out my writer binoculars and looked real close and realized he had these scars. And once I found that they were bullet wounds, it sort of struck me about how we all carry physical scars or sometimes mental scars with us from our past into our present. And they're stories, you know, scars have stories. They're usually stories that we only share with the people that we're the most intimate with, our lovers, or maybe our doctors. Sometimes the stories behind those scars are kind of lovely, like, oh, this is the scar I got when my dad was teaching me how to ride a bike. Sometimes they have darker backgrounds from an accident or a fight or something, or maybe from an operation. And I thought, what if I can try to tell a man's entire life story and only tell those stories? So that's where this book began, with this idea of what if I could skip through his life from the first scar that he got to the last scar that he gets on his body. So it starts when he's about 16 and goes to when he's about 50, just like a rock skipping through his life. And there's huge blank spaces in between, you know, just in the same way that I think with the people we love, we know some of the stories, and then there's big blank spaces that we'll never quite know about them. And the second part of the story became Lou, because I needed a reason for Samuel Holly to be on that greasy pole in the first place. I needed a reason for him to keep living, even though life kept trying to kill him. And that becomes his daughter. So the narratives weave in and out of each other. It becomes a kind of call and response. And I really think about the book almost as two coming of age stories together. It just takes Lou, you know, comes of age, she's about 17. For Holly, he has to be about 50 before he actually grows up.
And if they interweave, kind of the thread that is stitching them together is the number 12. And
yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that device?
Well, I knew that I wanted to tell the story of these different scars, and I was maybe 100 pages into the book when I struck upon the number 12. Part of that became I was rereading the Greek myths, and I read the story of Hercules and his 12 labors, and I found that his story was really dovetailing with a lot of what I was already dealing with Samuel Holly. Hercules is, you know, if you say the word Hercules, you think of this buff, strong, powerful man who achieved the impossible. But in fact, the reason why he went on those 12 labors in the first place was because he murdered his own wife and children. So he started in a very dark place, and his journey was really one about redemption. And Samuel Holly carries the weight of the death of his own wife and is sort of moving through the book about that. So it was the 12 labors of Hercules, and I put secret Easter eggs for each of the 12 labors into the book. And also there's the 12 signs of the zodiac, which became important for Lou, who's always looking up at the stars. And also time is very important in the book. So I was thinking about clocks
And because each of his flashbacks involve a woman, a bullet, and a clock.
Yes, a woman, a bullet, and a clock. So I was trying to write about death, love, and time. You know, easy subjects. Easy things.
And so at heart, there's something so beautiful and yet tragic about our two characters. I mean, Holly, every time they move to a new motel room, he sets up this shrine to his fallen wife of shampoo bottles and receipts and pictures, and then he spends hours in there. And then Lou, who is living without a mom and on the road and with a dad who is only kind of partially open to her. And yet you kind of weave these little acts that capture the love that exists between them, even if it is tinged with some sadness. Like right before the climax of the book, they come across this stuffed teddy bear floating in the ocean. I'm curious if you just read that paragraph on page 351 about the bear, and talk to us about planting those moments that kind of really breathe humanity into these characters.
Sure, the bear, the bear. It was a giant bear.
I guess we should say they're out at sea.
They're out at
they're
sea.
They're out at sea and they're looking
they're
for
They're out
someone.
At sea. They're looking for a lost person. And I guess I should preface this by just explaining a little bit about how I write, which is without any real plan. And oftentimes if I'm bored at the desk, I have this rule that I always tell my students with, if you are bored writing it, your reader is going to be bored reading it. So sometimes I'll just be going along and I just ask myself, what's the strangest thing that could happen right now? And then I try and make it happen. So they're out at sea, they see something, they go towards it. And I was like, is it a body? I don't know. Is it a body? I don't know. And I'm like, oh no, it was a giant bear. The kind Holly used to win for Lou at cheap roadside carnivals. A huge pink stuffed animal filled with shredded foam and sawdust and hung high to lure in marks. Holly would shoot out a paper star, and the carnies would hand over the prize, and Lou would stagger under the weight, refusing to let her father carry the bear and refusing to let go, shoving the animal into the seat next to them on the roller coaster, hugging the bear as they went up in the Ferris wheel, then strapping the bear into the car to go home. When they moved, there was never enough room to take it along. Holly always promised to win another at the next carnival to make it up to her, and when he did, they left that bear behind too. Now this waterlogged body seemed like a manifestation of all those abandoned animals, floating 110 miles out in international waters in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean with a rope around its neck.
I love that. So talk a little bit about, I mean, as the Washington Post says, this is a masterclass in literary suspense. So you have to move things forward and you really have mastered plot. But how do you know then to take those little breaths and inject something that kind of is a memory or a reflection?
It's a lot of it just comes as I'm going along. And then on later drafts, I try to identify certain objects or feelings and then develop them more. So with that bear, for example, the first time he showed up was the first draft of that scene when I was like, I don't know what's in the water. What's in the water? It's a giant bear. And then I was like, wait, all right, so I need to put another bear in earlier. And what did the bear look like? I described it and I really imagined one of those, you know, really crappy bears that you somehow seem so wonderful, right? They're so poorly made, and it's just, as a kid, that's all you want is one of those giant bears. And so then I was able to input earlier in the book some of their visits to the carnivals, and also there's a bear skin rug that is also important in the book that is my version of the lion skin that Hercules wears. So Holly wears I was like, what's the American version of a lion? That would be a bear, so he wears a bear skin sometimes.
I'm curious, Holly himself, he progresses in his flashbacks from petty theft to really expensive theft to murderer, cold-blooded murderer, and yet he's so sympathetic to the readers. How did you walk that line between hero and anti-hero, the same line that Hercules kind of strolled all those years ago?
Well, I purposely put his darkest self later in the book so that I think if I put those scenes first, it would be hard for the reader to feel connected to him. But I don't know. I think that both Samuel Holly and Lou are both characters who have a hard time connecting with other people. I have a hard time sometimes connecting to other people. I think that's one of the reasons why I'm a writer. So I'm really interested in that, which is, you know, how do you make relationships when it can be so hard to be vulnerable, when it can be so hard to connect to others? And the book is for me is they're both learning how to do that. And so for Samuel Hawley, even though he does do some pretty terrible things, I think the reader is on his side. I was on his side. Because you see the struggles, because he really just wants to try to connect.
And possibly sometime in the near future, the viewer might be on his side, because the book has been optioned by Matt Reeves, who most recently did Planet of the Apes. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Well, I'm excited. It's been optioned for a television series, and they're working on the script. Jez Butterworth, the playwright, is writing it. He's probably most well-known for his play Jerusalem. But he also did several movie scripts like James Bond, Spectre, and also a movie that I really love called Edge of Tomorrow with Tom Cruise in it. It actually made me really like Tom Cruise, and I don't normally like Tom Cruise, but it's a well-written movie. And it kind of connects to this because he dies over and over again, just like...
That's why you like it, right?
Samuel Hawley keeps getting shot over and over again, so, yeah.
Excellent. Well, Hannah Tinti's new novel is The 12 Lives of Samuel Hawley. Hannah, it's been such a pleasure talking with
you. Thank you, Aaron. This was great.
And thank you all so much for joining us today at Wordstock, Portland's Book Festival. State of Wonder is produced by April Baer and myself. Our technical producer is Stephen Cray. Production assistance by Nicholas Hennessy. Our executive producer is Sarah Rothenfletch. The music for today came from Audio Network. A very special thanks to Amanda Bullock and all the staff and volunteers at Literary Arts for all the work they put into making Wordstock happen. They navigate a labyrinth of scheduling each year that I'm pretty certain not even Theseus could survive. So thank you all. I'm Aaron Scott. We hope you all found some reads to fire your imagination today. We'll see you back here next year.